originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, along with my usual entry mate here on the network. That's the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld. We are coming to you from our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios right here in the heart of the Bluegrass, Lexington, Kentucky. And do want to extend a very special welcome to everybody joining us again tonight on Sirius 219 XM Channel 206, and all of you tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer, your smartphone, your tablet, whatever the case may be. You're doing that on our website at horseracingradio.net, and very happy to have you with us for this special edition of Trainer Talk. And JT, a couple of weeks ago, we had the chance to visit with trainer Todd Pletcher, and Todd had been on this program when we first started the show back in 2012, and we kind of came back with a part two, which was nice because you remember when we first started the show, we were visiting with trainers for 25 or 30 minutes, so we never really got an opportunity to dive into some of the horses that they've been part of and some of the different stories that they've been able to be associated with throughout their career. We were able to do that with Todd. We're going to do that here tonight as well.
Yeah, well, it's a great opportunity, and it's really nice of these top trainers to give us the time, because everybody knows how hard they work, and there's not enough hours in the day, many days, when you're training horses. So we appreciate it, and I know the listeners really enjoy it, and they're fellow trainers. This is the show that trainers listen to.
Yeah, well, speaking of top trainers, we have a good one for you this evening. That is trainer Al Stahl Jr., who first joined us on Trainer Talk back on November 21st of 2012. Well, since that time, well, he's still been active. He's saddled more than 260 additional winners and is currently, how about this, currently winning at a 26% clip during the first 2.5 months of 2017. I will warn you, if he does get a bit cranky over the course of the next hour, it is only because he's given up drinking for Lent. Al Stahl Jr. with us now here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Al, welcome, my friend.
Oh, thanks, guys. It's good to be back on the show.
Can you do the full hour knowing that there's no alcohol in the system?
Yeah, no, I think I'm officially cleaned out by now. Mardi Gras was over 3 weeks ago, so I think I'm in good shape.
Is that a traditional thing for people in New Orleans to give up drinking? That's a tough town to not be able to go out and socialize.
Yeah, well, it's a religious thing, Catholic, and people blow it out pretty strongly during the. We've had such a long with Mardi Gras being so late this year, from Thanksgiving to Mardi Gras, which was February 28th. That's a pretty long season of going full bore. So I know quite a few people who did give it up, and I guess this year a lot of people really were looking forward to it. But now that it's all run through everybody's system and everybody's freshened up again, they're saying to themselves, oh, why in the world did I do that? I got a whole nother month plus. So anyway, that's just a commitment I made. I don't do it every year. I just do it every so often. And this year I just decided to do it, and here we are.
How about you? Did you give yourself one big blowout on Mardi Gras?
You know, actually not really. I ride in a parade during the Mardi Gras season on Friday before Tuesday, Fat Tuesday. And so that was my last hurrah. I actually stopped. I got a little bit of a head start, and I stopped the Friday. Well, I guess it was the 24th. So I'm actually coming up on 4 weeks this week. So I with family and all that stuff, I was just strong and steady. I was a San Juan Capistrano horse.
There you go. I'm sure your liver appreciates it.
Yeah, no doubt.
Well, Al, I mentioned it's been since 2012 since you appeared on this program. Of course, you joined us on the network several times over the past 5 years for, you know, different interviews surrounding some of your big horses. But I guess the main question is, what you've been up to over the course of the past 4.5 years?
Yeah, well, everything in this game is we're creatures of habit. It's been pretty routine. I stay on the same circuit for the last, I'm not sure how many years it is, basically Louisiana, Kentucky, with a little sojourn to Saratoga. So that's basically what I've been doing, and just trying to, you know, do the best we can with what we have and just stay steady as she goes.
That's a pretty nice schedule to keep, because we've been talking about New Orleans and what a great place it is to be, and then the racing there is excellent, and you're a kingpin in your home state, and then, you know, come to Keeneland, and that never hurt anybody, and Saratoga, it's rarefied air pretty much.
Yeah, no, we're literally like a bird. We just fly north when it starts to get warm, and when it gets cold, we just turn around and start coming down from north to south. So, yeah, it's a good routine, and it's been good for us. It keeps us, it keeps the barn full of horses, and I wouldn't want to venture anywhere else just yet, because I know Kentucky and Louisiana, two places that all my clients are for the most part.
Al Stahl Jr., our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Al, let's just start by recapping what we went over when you joined us back in 2012. We talked a lot about your upbringing and being a native of New Orleans and your grandfather and father being involved in the sport. We talked about Frankie Brothers being your longtime mentor and a true friend of the family, and Frankie an assistant to Jack Vanberg, who you also spent a little bit of time around, and then you went out on your own in 1991. One thing I'm curious about, Frankie taught you how to deal with the hot and cold streaks that come along with training racehorses, and at the top of the interview tonight, I talked about winning at a 26% clip here in 2017. Talk about your approach to dealing with the good times and the not-so-good times.
Right. You know, those are, I'm assuming you're reading those facts right there, but that's you know more about it than I do. you hit the refresh button in my mind, but the thing is not to change. I mean, you can change a little bit, but not like, oh my goodness, my horses aren't running well. Let's change the feed. The subtle changes that you pick up as you go along and how the game changes and things like that. That's okay, but even when things are down, we still feed the same way, and you know, we're always happy with the way our horses look, and just kind of work hard, and you ride out the softer times, and usually down the road, and you get paid for it. And this year is a prime example of that. I mean, it's a prime example of the quiet summer we had with various injuries and things like that, and we just rode it out, and here we are, you know, going along pretty strong since basically Thanksgiving to now.
Yeah, that's the patience factor in racing. And talk about that. So many trainers nowadays seem to want to make this particular race, or they are pointing for the Kentucky Derby or whatever, and they try to make the horses do things maybe that isn't what the horse wants to do. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's something I've never really – I'm assuming I'm falling into that trap somewhere along the line, but that's something that I've I don't say it comes naturally to me. I guess it came naturally to Frankie. We just never, you know, this with year-round racing, and we're on a really good circuit, and there's just no reason. The only precious commodity you have is a horse, and you just got to get them right where you want them before you pull the trigger. And you spend a lot of time and a lot of effort and, of course, a lot of money with the owners of the horses. And it just doesn't make sense to me to do something when it's just not quite right. And I can't think of but maybe a handful of times over the years that you kind of got away with something with a little rush job. But 9 times out of 10 or 99 times out of 100, pay me now or pay me later. So I just rather wait things out and run when we all feel comfortable.
Well, Frankie and Jack were very much like that too, weren't they, Al?
Say that again. I'm sorry. I missed it.
Frankie and Jack, they were very much like that. They took that same approach when they were training their horses.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, Frankie was really, he's you know, he has the same type outfit that I have. Jack had, you know, he was the original, you know, assistant trainers at every racetrack and all those umpteen thousands of races that he won. So he played it all up and down from cheap horses to the Ali Sheba types. And Frankie started off that way when I was younger. And then when I kind of really was awake and following closely, he had worked hard enough as a young man to get the good horses, the Joe Albrightons and, you know, that type of thing. And so he was dealt a lot of maidens, which he was happy to have because the maidens are the ones who can take you where you want to go. And you've got to really, you know, train a maiden that you buy as a yearling or, you know, a non-starter type horse. You've got to take a completely different approach than a horse you claim for, you know, 15,000 and you're looking to run them back in 2 or 3 weeks. So that's what I really got out of, you know, got out of being with Frankie. When he transitioned from being a so-called claiming trainer to the better horses, I was right in the middle of all that. And I, you know, I could just see the difference. And that's kind of my stable's modeled after that. I usually have a bunch of horses that we start from scratch with and we, you know, play our hand. So you have to have patience when you start like that.
You know, what happens when you have a maiden and maybe somebody's paid a lot of money for it or whatever and just isn't meeting expectations and you have to put it in a claiming race? What's the philosophy there and how do you explain that to the owner?
Well, you just first thing you analyze a horse is, you know, as much as you can. I mean, you got to make sure there's nothing bothering the horse. A lot of times I've turned horses out just for poor performance and they've come back better horses. That'll happen. So I guess if you start seeing a horse that's just not showing much, you know, we'll just shut them down 60, 90 days, start over again, give them a chance. And if they don't come back to meet expectations, you put the miles in them. And if the light doesn't come on, you just have to have a heart to heart with the owner and say, you know, we've given this horse every chance. What do you want to do? Here are your options, race A, B, C, or donate it to a riding club, you know, anything, that type of thing. So I've done all of that. And, you know, if you tell them up front, you're truthful with them. Everybody knows this game is, you know, full of heartbreak and that happens. So I just kind of give them every chance I can possibly give them. And when we run out of options, it's just a harsh reality that we have to face.
Al, along those same lines, how about a horse that becomes known in the sport as a morning glory, where they show all kinds of ability and talent in their morning training, but you get them to the races in the afternoon, and for whatever reason, they just continually fail to show up? How frustrating is that for a trainer?
Yeah, that's a terrible thing to have. You know, especially if you really feel comfortable with telling a guy or a person that we think this is a nice animal that can win a few races at the allowance level, and then all of a sudden everybody shows up and the first race doesn't go well, and you say, okay, well, inexperience, and then you do the next one and doesn't go well, then you go to grass, and then sometimes you just got to say, you know, if it's a colt or something like that, you can talk about castration or, you know, but just it's another thing in the game that just happens. There are horses like that. From a training standpoint, those are just about the ones you dislike as much as you could possibly dislike a horse. You know, everybody's here for the love of the horse, but those are the ones that kind of aggravate you and you pin it on the horse a little bit. The ones that just don't have that much ability, no matter what the pedigree is, that's the way it is. But a horse that's not giving it to you is frustrating, and it's just another reality that we have to deal with.
Yeah, it's kind of the opposite is true too. The horses that you love are the ones that maybe don't have good confirmation or don't have that pedigree, and they give you everything they've got every time, and they might not be good enough to even win a race, but they're out there trying their best every day. And then you get one of those horses that has all this ability and they don't want to do it in the afternoon, and it's not a good thing.
Yeah, no, that's all you can ask for, just like you would do your children or something. All you want, just try, you know, try and make A, study hard for this test. Just try, and they'll take themselves wherever they're going to go. But there are horses that don't try. I just read just recently some quote from Eddie Arcaro saying something along those lines. Somebody pulled something out of the way back And I couldn't agree. They're just horses who just don't give you what they have. And those are the ones that are tough to deal with.
Well, as Jude mentioned, it goes both ways. How about the flip side of that, Al, where you've had a horse in the mornings that doesn't show you much, and you're thinking, well, maybe he can win a race or two, and all of a sudden he surprises you, and he turns out to be extremely competitive and very, very good in the afternoons. Tell me about a horse that you've had come through your program like that.
Well, yeah, there's certain like sire lines or can be that way. Like Arches can be that way a little bit. In the morning, they can be, strong and solid and good gallopers and a little bit one pace. And then when you take them over there, they run a little bit better than you think. So I haven't had a horse that I thought was going to be a claiming horse and all of a sudden just show up and just be a lights-out horse. I know some famous horses have been that way. I think like a Shotto might have been a little bit like that. I kind of remember Todd talking about her, and I actually can remember Spicetown, I think, being a little bit like that. For some reason, I remember Todd saying stuff like that, a horse that, goes a half and 50 and then runs 7/8 and 20 and 3/5. But I haven't had one quite like that. But there are certain horses that just get up for game day, and those are awfully nice to have because, they're easy. They're easy on themselves in the morning. That's a trainer's delight when you have a horse that really lays it on, puts it on the line in the afternoon. Yet, if you want a horse to go in 51 and keep their weight and keep their energy and keep their appetite, that's actually the horse you really are looking for.
Yeah, there's nothing that beats a horse that surprises you like that. I love the Spitestown story. I had a filly one time, and I tried to get my friend Joe Steiner to ride her, and I had worked her one morning in front of the owner, and he comes back. He says, yeah, that's a nice filly. She'll win for 12.5. Well, he didn't know who the horse was, but she was a stakes horse. She ended up making $500,000 on the dirt. She won a grade two. And the owner looks at me and goes, I don't know if I want him to ride the horse or not.
No, that's right. Well, the jocks and the trainers, you gotta keep your mouth shut until the very last minute. You don't want to put your neck on the line because owners have very good memories, that's for sure.
Yeah.
One of the things that people will remember about Al Stahl from that first show back 4.5 years ago is that Al graduated from LSU, and he graduated with a degree in geology, almost took a whole separate career path from training horses. He was in the oil business for a while. But Al, much like the horse business, you've had to ride through some highs and lows with your LSU Tigers and their football program over the past few years too.
Oh, there's no question about it. It's kind of frustrating. In horse terms, there was plenty of talent in the morning, but we weren't seeing it in the afternoon. I mean, you can witness the drafts over the past 10 years or so. So, I mean, they weren't really showing up, and all of a sudden you see these guys going the first round, and then all of a sudden you got an Odell Beckham and all these guys who were on the same team, these, phenomenal athletes in the pros, and we weren't just getting in the afternoon, so I don't get too involved in a coaching deal and all that, but I didn't hurt my feelings that they made a little move with Les Miles, and now we got Coach O, Ogeron, who's a local boy, obviously. I think he and I are the exact same age. He's a tough guy, and they sure played for him as an interim coach, and here we go again. So come August, come Labor Day, the Tiger Nation will be all fired up because we're looking for that fresh start with all these good recruits, and we'll be sky high at least for the first month of the season. Hopefully, we don't get knocked down right off the bat.
How many games will you try to go to each year?
It's been harder and harder. I mean, I keep season tickets, and the only reason I don't turn them back in, well, I don't want to. A, but B, I'd go back on a 50,000 person waiting list. Mm-hmm. So we've had these tickets for a long time, and it just depends on the circumstances. If I come to check on the horses, the Fairgrounds barn area opens up in October, and I just happen to look at my free schedule to come check on the horse. And I was like, oh, look, there's a game in Baton Rouge, so I can, slide over there. So, try and catch a couple of them at least, and then otherwise some friends and family use the tickets, and we just want to keep them in circulation.
Is it hard to go to LSU because of being so close to New Orleans?
Well, you know, the school that I went to, a high school where Odell Beckham and the Mannings and all these have Michael Lewis, the author, and Tom Amos, they kind of want their students to go to, you know, Princeton and all this. And in our year, we had about a 77-person class. We had about 15 of us just took the easy button and went to LSU in Baton Rouge. And you know, I wouldn't have traded the experience for the world. I just had such a good time. And, you know, the good thing about doing that is being from New Orleans and going to somewhere close to New Orleans is, you know, the friends I had in high school, the friends I had in college, they're all still around. So, you know, I still got a nucleus of people who I could call, and we're on email chains, and, you know, we're literally blocks apart from each other, and I run into them all the time. I think that's a good way to go through life is having your people around you as much as possible.
You mean Princeton wouldn't accept you?
Yeah, exactly. I took the ACT test, and back in those days, I don't know if they do it now, I didn't even apply to LSU, and I got a letter from them. Congratulations, you've been accepted. I said, I like this. That's where I'm going. I literally didn't even fill out an application. So I thought that was pretty neat. So that's how that went down.
He's Al Stahl Jr. He is our guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton. Al, the other thing that you're passionate about, being a native of New Orleans, is the New Orleans Saints. And you've recently had the opportunity to train for the owners of the Saints and the Pelicans. That's Tom and Gail Benson. Tell me a little bit about that relationship and what's it like now for you as a New Orleans kid being involved with them.
Yeah, it's a concept that Greg Bensel, who's the vice president, a media guy, communications and media for the Saints, who's a horse racing fan. He's around my age, and he's a good guy, and Mr. Benson has been in the horse game for, you know, 40 years. He's had a ranch / farm most of his adult life, and he's a horse guy. He just kind of got away from the game. You know, Billy Fox Jr., I mean, not Jr., Billy Fox Sr., Dale Romans, his father-in-law, was his trainer. And I remember his horses from when I was a kid in high school. So he's always had an interest in the game. And then when Ben Sewell got involved, he came up with the idea of, let's get the three local boys, me, Tom, and Dallas Stewart, to he gave us complete autonomy. And he gave us, I forgot what the first bankroll was, $400,000 each or something like that. And we all decided that the Keeneland September sale was the right place to go. And we bought horses, and out of the first crop, they've got Mo Tom and Tom's Ready. And then I was a little bit behind with that Tom's They Taught, but the way he ran this past Monday, we might be back in the game for Mr. Benson with another first crop horse. And we repeated again this year, so we've all got another slew of 2-year-olds coming up. You'll see more this summer.
Well, that's always great, and now the Pelicans are like a UK South.
Yes, it is. It is, and they're not going to make it this year, but it'll be just like LSU with Cousins and obviously Davis and a couple moves here. I guess everybody would be kind of high on them, you know, gelling, so to speak, for next year. So it's just been a complete pleasure, and very lucky to, you know, be from New Orleans and have, you know, they're very loyal people. The Bensons are, and you know, they just enjoy it, and they're going to be, they got that farm they bought in your neck of the woods, and they're going to be at Keeneland on Bluegrass Day, and they're having a little reception out there a couple days later out in Paris, and they're coming back up for Derby. And I mean, they're, you know, for a 90-year-old man, no grass grows under his feet. It's kind of amazing, really. He's very much involved, and he really enjoys it. And like I said, it's kind of in his blood because he's been doing this for a long time.
And Mrs. Benson, she's a real sweetheart. We had her on at Derby time, and she was just a delightful lady.
I knew her. She lived across the street from my parents for years, so I kind of knew her before she married Mr. Benson, and she was always a very pleasant woman, and she's just done really great things for the city of New Orleans, and you can't even describe the charitable actions that they take for various organizations. I was sitting with them Monday afternoon before Tom's They Taught ran, and Mr. Benson is going to pick up a hospital bill for one of the – did you read where a drunk driver ran over some people at a parade in Mardi Gras about a month ago.
Yeah.
And one of the people who are still in the hospital, something to do with their, they were from out of state and their insurance didn't, for some reason, the insurance only worked in the state the guy resided in. So here he was on a vacation and this horrible thing happened to him. And he's going to go visit him personally and he's going to, you know, help him with the tab and, you know, just things like that that nobody's asking to do. And, I mean, I'm sure they most probably might cover it when the time comes, but I heard him talking about it and just, you know, just, that's just what they do.
Yeah, they're great people, and we really enjoy getting to know them. Last year at the Kentucky Derby, you mentioned them choosing three local trainers with Tom Amos and Dallas Stewart and yourself. Is there a bit of a friendly rivalry between the three of you when you're training their horses, all trying to kind of get to the top first, so to speak?
I'd be absolutely lying to you if I said no. Yeah, no question about it.
I thought there might be.
Yeah, no question about it.
Who's the biggest?
It's friendly though. It's friendly, but everybody keeps an eye on everybody else's moves, you know. And it's most probably a healthy thing. And most probably, the Bensons and Greg Bensel, they might have designed it that way because they're getting everybody's best shot. You can believe that.
Who's the biggest smack talker among the three? Dallas?
Oh no question. Yeah, absolutely. You know that. So yeah, but it's a kick, and you know, we're all looking forward to, you know, well, I mean, Mo Tom is going to run New Orleans Handicap, and Tom's ready. I think he's going to run the Churchill Downs Handicap, and Tom Vitas is going to run Derby Week also, and then we're looking for this crop to run themselves to wherever they end up, and then boom, here come. I think everybody got three, so we have like nine babies coming up this year, so there's a lot to look forward to, and you know, he's the type of client, Mr. Benson and Gale, is to. It kind of keeps you going because they're nice to deal with, and they let you break the horses where you want to do them and run them where you want to run them. So it's you're on the line every time one sets foot out there.
Tom Amos might be out for a little revenge. If I remember correctly, Al, from the first show that we did together, you actually fired Tom Amos in the first month of your career.
In the first month of my career?
Isn't that what you told me?
No, I don't think so.
Well, you should have.
Well, I brought him. He wanted to, we walked Hot Stern Christmas. I think it was our freshman year in college, or something like that. And I think it was his first taste of the track. I mean, I'd been doing the summers and stuff during high school, and he lasted about 10 days. And he had to. I was walking a horse. And I was looking in the office, and there he was sitting there talking to Frankie Brothers. And I said, "What? What's he doing in there talking to Frankie Brothers?" And we were riding home, and he said, "You don't need to pick me up in the morning. I quit." I said, "Okay." So that's all that was, and obviously that didn't deter him. He's rocked it pretty good for the last 30 years.
Yeah, he certainly has. One of the top trainers in the game today. Al Stahl Jr., our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton. Al, stay with us. We're going to take a short commercial break. We'll come back with the second half of the show and look back on some of those horses that have been so good to you over the years. That's next on Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton.
Nominate your yearlings now to the Fezzik Tipton Summer Selected Yearling Sales. These sales are the top three yearling sales in North America by rate of return. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky, July 10th and 11th. The Saratoga sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 7th and 8th. And the New York Bred sale in Saratoga Springs, New York, August 12th and 13th. Selected sales, superior results. Nominate today at FezzikTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at BloomRacing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Rosa Maya, what a finish to the classic.
and to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Zenyatta now hooking to the grandstand side, and Zenyatta is now coming with a run, looking at Lucky Blame. Blame on the inside, Blame gets the lead. Zenyatta on the outside, looking at Lucky Blame. Zenyatta, Zenyatta, Zenyatta is flying. Blame trying to hold on. Blame and Zenyatta.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Jude Feld in our Jimmy Johns of Lexington broadcast studios here in Lexington, Kentucky. Trevor Denman with the call of that 2010 Breeders' Cup Classic, Blame, defeating Zenyatta beneath the lights at Churchill Downs. Of course, we were there. Al Stahl was there. He saddled Blame that evening. And boy, what a performance. We're going to talk to Al Stahl in the second half of the program. The first half was simply outstanding. If you did miss any portion, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net or Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes, and check out the podcast of this program and all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure. JT, we're going to talk about so many of the big horses that Al's been around here in the second half of the show, including Blame, but that was a night you and I will never forget.
Oh, it was just one of the most awesome day / evenings of racing that I was ever around. And, you know, Al's horse had trained brilliantly up to that race, and Zenyatta, of course, was riding the big win streak, and you couldn't ask for a finer moment. And we are so lucky where we're stationed at Churchill Downs, right on the finish line above everything, getting to see that race. Well, really a thrill.
Al, how about for you? When you hear that call, what goes through your mind?
Well, yeah, it never gets old, that's for sure. It was just something that you'll never forget, obviously. You know, we just focused on Blame the whole time. I mean, obviously we were very cognizant of Zenyatta and 19 for 19, but you know, when you're kind of in your own little world leading up to the race, at least I was. We felt our horse had come up to the race just like we wanted him to, and all systems were go. And the closer you get to the race, you know, the less and less you have control over. It's the horse and then the rider and things like that. So we thought we had everything covered, and it was just one of the races where you obviously had no idea what was going to happen. At least I didn't. I mean, sure, we felt like we had a great shot. We were bringing the right horse over at the right time. But it's the Breeders' Cup Classic, and it's Zenyatta, and it's other good horses, and it's $5 million. You know, you just really don't know what's going to happen. So when it happens, you're still in shock. It's like, oh my goodness, I can't believe that just happened. So, and it still feels that way to this day.
You still can't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to believe. It's an experience that, you know, I'm. That's why I get up and do what we do, try and get it again one of these days. So that's what I feel about it. At least there was a bunch of cofactors that made it just the highlight of, you know, my career by far.
Yeah, it was simply a spectacular night. And you started your career in 1991, and you started with just one horse. Which horse was the one that you would say really kick-started your career?
I'm trying to think. I mean, there was plenty of others. We got a fairly fast start and got a stable going along pretty good, like by 98. I mean, the first big horse was Joyo Danseur from B. Wayne Hughes, who was a horse he bought in America as a yearling and went to France. And the trainer who had him was a super famous trainer, Francois Boutin. And I think he passed away, and there was some sort of tax consequence. Whatever it was, he brought him back to America, and I just hooked up with Wayne on a small scale, and And he said, well, let's just give this guy a four-year-old maiden, whoever, you know, see what he can do. End up being a, you know, grade one stakes winner. He won early times on Derby Day, matter of fact. And I guess he was the first, quote-unquote, big horse to win, you know, a graded stake, well, grade one stake, actually.
Yeah, he was a good horse, always long on the turf. And typical of Wayne Hughes in those days, he used to buy a lot of those European horses, and he liked racing in Europe probably more than he did in the United States.
Right, right. Yeah, he ended up in there. I mean, well, you know George Vogel. Jude knows George well, and he's a California guy. But, yeah, he did end up with a lot of European horses, and he certainly changed his program around. He's got things going his way also. But he's been one of my guys from the very beginning.
Al, how much do things change for a horse trainer when they finally break through and train a grade one winner?
It does. A, you get a sense of satisfaction that you say, hey, you know, given the right bullet, I can fire it. It helps your confidence. And, of course, it gets more attention. And, you know, I can't quantitate what that means as far as horse numbers and purse money and all that. But from a personal standpoint, it makes you feel like you belong, so to speak. And, obviously, you know, people send you horses as a result of it. So, It's a very win-win type of thing when you can get to that level.
Let's have a little fun, Al. Let's walk back through some of the names of those horses that you've won graded stakes with over your career. And there's several of them, but let's start with this name and tell me what comes to mind. Julianis.
Julianis. Helen Alexander was managing the Darley horses, whatever year that was. And I knew... kind of, they were. I actually had a couple Darley horses in the very beginning, via Johnny Jones, and you know I would kind of see them running America, and I knew basically they were for sale. And I noticed this horse out in California, Neil Drysdale, and I called Helen, and she said, "Yeah, sure, we'd sell the horse, and I think he'll vet out." And so we brought him from west to east, and he was an old, sour, Allie Dar horse, a little bit obstreperous, and he wanted to do things his way or not do things at all. And we ended up castrating him, and I think that's what turned the corner on him. And he went ahead, and I guess you're looking at he won the Razorback. I think it was a grade two then at Oaklawn. But, yeah, we bought him privately from Darley, and Neil had him. And he ended up being a nice horse. He ran. He was inconsistent. He'd run great one time and not show up the next time. When he fired, he was a live horse.
Yeah, that's always always kind of funny when you have a horse like that. You know, they're capable of big races, but they don't always show up. What do you think the reason for that is?
Well, I just think he was those Allie Dars could be that way. It was just purely his temperament. It wasn't anything physical. Towards the end of his career, we had to redo him in the starting gate. He started kind of halfway refusing to break, and he came right out of that too. But you know, he was just, I think that particular horse, it was an individual. He was just like that.
How about another horse that gave you a graded win back in the 1990s when you were really just kind of getting rolling? And that's a horse by the name of Formal Tango. What do you remember about Formal Tango?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Right. No, Formal Tango, Paul Holtis claimed the mare for a good friend of ours, a good friend of mine, a good friend of Tom Amos's, named Mike Rainier, out of Dallas, Texas. And she was by Sir Ivor and didn't do so well. And Mike was friends with a bunch of people who, the guy ended up dying. I'm drawing a blank, but, Nathan Fox. Nathan's alive. But there was another guy who they're all buddies, and they bought Dynaformer off the racetrack. It was Nathan Fox used to do things for the B team for Three Chimneys. That's the setup there. And these guys invested in Dynaformer off the racetrack, and he used his Dynaformer to breed this filly, Formal Tango, in the early days of Dynaformer. And she was not a big filly, but she was put together properly and showed run right off the bat. And we got her on the grass She was very consistent, and she was a nice filly. I remember she won the Eatontown, I think, or the Red Bank over at Monmouth, and J.D. Bailey rode her for her. So we had a good time because Mike's a good friend of mine who just kept a small stable, and it was exciting. What you call a fun horse.
Yeah, that's great when you can win for your friends. There's nothing like that.
Yeah, no question. We those poor horses were sure tired because every time they'd win, boy, we'd talk about it and replay those races. They had to run those races over and over again.
Well, following Formal Tango, here came Bright Valor and Discreet Hero in the early part of that decade of the 2000s. How about Bright Valor and Discreet Hero?
Right. Bright Valor was a Lazy Lane horse. Wild Again, big, grand-looking horse. I think Frankie might have had Bright Valor early in his career, and then Frankie went to Claiborne, and Mr. Albritton sent him to me, and he was kind of a straightforward horse. Like I say, he was a really nice horse. He ran a monster race off the bench at the fairgrounds, and I might have run him back a little quick at Keeneland, and he was a little flat. And then he got in a little bit of a rhythm that summer, and he won that stake up at Arlington with Robbie. Yeah, that was a nice horse, a good way to get started with Lazy Lane. And Discreet Hero was a really nice, fun horse. Another fun horse. I bought him as a weanling, of all things. I wouldn't know a weanling if he was standing right here in front of me for the most part. And Wayne said, hey, go see if you like anything. And I found this little cute horse. he just looked like a little toy horse. And we ended up buying him. And he ended up being a Discreet Hero, who was a horse that hung around for a while, and he won the round table, and probably should have done a little bit more, but a little this and a little that kept him from doing that. But, yeah, he was the only weanling I've ever bought, and he ended up being kind of nice. So maybe I have something to fall back on when I get older.
You should hit all the weanling sales. That's great.
He's trainer Al Stahl Jr. He is with us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on HRRN. Al, then we get into that later part, right around 2008, and you start getting into working with a lot of those Claiborne horses, and here comes Lattice, who wins the Grade 3 Louisville Handicap. Tell me about Lattice.
Yeah, Lattice was a Billy Mott horse. Had him earlier. Big, strong, typical Claiborne-looking horse. Just gorgeous animal. Beautiful way of moving. Very, very temperamental. When you get a horse from Billy Mott, there's usually, they're not beat up, which is a luxury. I mean, it was great. There was plenty to work with, and we got some races in him, and then we decided to run him that marathon race at Louisville, and he just steadily, grinded away, and he won it nicely. But he was a really horse you'd be proud to lead over in the afternoon. I mean, he took up a lot of eyes when he walked in the paddock.
Yeah, he certainly was special. And then you had a part who came along, owned by Adil Dilschneider, and that Claiborne connection. And a part was a horse that was so, so good. On his day, he could really run.
Yeah, a part was another grand-looking horse by Flatter. I think he got a little shadow in a condyle as a two-year-old, shut him down, brought him back. And I remember he broke his maiden the day after Blaine won the Schaefer at Pimlico. It was a Sunday after Preakness, and Solis rode him, and it was a muddy racetrack, and he was 10, 15 lengths out of it down the backside, and he just, when I tell you, he went through those group of horses and ended up winning by 6 or 7, and we looked at each other. Del Hancock was there, and Adil Dilschneider was there, and we all said, that's our Super Derby horse. That's exactly what we said, and we wiggled our way through the summer, ended up going down and winning the Super Derby. He was just a nice horse, and he was a strange horse because I thought he was going to really get better and better because he was a big strapping horse, and the pedigree said the same. And he got a little, he just didn't try too hard for us, and he was one of the first horses that got the subchondral bone bruising in my stable that we, I guess, with the technology and everything, we sent him to the scintigraphy, and that's what they called on him, and maybe that was the reason why he didn't perform. So we shut him down. I think he was living out at Claiborne Farm, and Dell was riding him, and I think he's with like a fancy hunter jumper guy in Pennsylvania now. So he's still in the family, but yeah, he was a very nice horse and like another great looking animal.
You know, that relationship you had with Claiborne really was tremendous. It dated all the way back to your mentor, Frankie Brothers. And then in April of 2009, you started working with the Claiborne horses. It finally came to an end in the middle of 2016. And Al, I don't know if you realize how successful you really were with those Claiborne horses, but here's some of the statistics. 179 victories with the Claiborne horses. That included 16 stakes victories for them, with 16 stakes horses, I should say. Those runners earned more than $13 million in purses, of course, highlighted by Blame, who won the $5 million Breeders' Cup Classic. When an ownership group like that makes a decision to kind of change things up and move on, how difficult is that for a trainer?
Well, I have a, you know, it's not the easiest thing in the world, but maybe it's just me personally. I've been around this game my whole life, and I'm not that temperamental. You know, your feelings get hurt a little bit, your pride, but it didn't, you know, I didn't stay up at night. And I mean, I know how this game is as much as anybody. And I just know to get up every morning when that alarm clock goes off and head out to that barn and, you know, train the horses you have behind those webbings. And I kind of take that approach to everything. And it wasn't, there wasn't an acrimonious, split. I talked to Walker 2 or 3 days ago, and I had a texting conversation with Seth a couple Sundays ago. And, you know, we talked about a whole bunch of different things just on the text messages about our, you know, our mutual friend Larry Melanson and some of the things that happen off the racetrack. And, you know, I still have horses for Adele. So, you know, we had a winner, she had a nice winner at Oaklawn last week. And so, you know, everything is okay. And, you know, it wasn't like a yelling match and things like that. It just kind of drifted off into the sunset and you know, and everybody's fine.
Yeah, you talked earlier about confidence, and I think you have that in spades. As often as trainers get fired in this business, you know what happens, but you have the confidence to know that no matter what horses you have, you're going to get the best out of them, and that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, I'm not going to take it out on anybody, including myself. So we're just going to keep on rocking. That's just what we do.
Al, only a few minutes left before we have to move on and wrap things up here for this edition of Trainer Talk. But what? Just kind of curious, what have you enjoyed most about this journey and your career in racing?
Well, it's the horses first. I mean, it's just... you know, I had to was bitten by the bug, you know, as a young child, and you know, I still take a lot of pleasure in being around them and trying to get them to look as good as they can possibly look, and you know, and of course then comes the good performances as a result of that usually, and you know, that's one of the things I still get a lot of pleasure, peace of mind out of, and obviously what it's done for me and my family. And, you know, it's kept everybody, you know, keeps us together. I mean, we'll run a horse here and my sister will be here, my brother and my mother. And, you know, we'll have all that, you know, still going on. And that's not going to be like that, you know, till the end of time. So, it's been good on a family level. And of course, then the people you meet along the way. And, you know, it certainly hasn't been a job. It's been a passion, and it's been a pleasure to do. And sure, there's a lot of ups and downs, and a lot of times you don't want to come bouncing out of bed, but that's all part of it. But I'm so thrilled I end up going down this road, I can't even begin to tell you.
Well, we talked about your personal interests in the New Orleans Saints and the LSU Tigers, being an LSU alum, and I know you enjoy playing golf when you get a chance to. What's left on the Al Stahl bucket list, both personally and professionally? What things do you still want to accomplish?
Well, I mean, I just want to keep raising my family, you know, raise, you know, proper kids and make sure everybody's happy and healthy and go on to be self-sufficient and, you know, just do the right thing under any kind of circumstances, whether it be good times or bad times. So, I mean, that's a personal goal. And as far as the horses, I want to win all the races, but I want to just continue to try and build a stable and win the bigger events. Cause it's when you've been there and you've got a little taste of, you want to go back and it's exciting. And that's just where I am in my career. I just want to try to keep building and you know, you lose 4 out of 5 races and you're a superstar in this game, but So you're very much used to losing, but so you really have to appreciate the wins, and I still do, and I really look forward to trying having some more big races.
No, there's nobody better. He's Al Stahl Jr. doing a phenomenal job, as we mentioned, in 2017, winning at a 26% clip here in 2017. Simply spectacular. Al, keep it rolling, my friend. We'll look forward to seeing you when you get back up north.
Yep, no, it won't be long. I'm looking forward to it. We're going to hit the ground running opening day at Keeneland.
Yeah, you got My Mischief in Sunday. I'll be there.
Yes, Sunday. we got Yaki's Warrior in the Commonwealth and a few others. So we've got a lot to look forward to.
We'll be there. We'll be getting down.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's do it. Thanks, Al. We appreciate it.
All right, Jen. Thank you. Bye.
Al Stahl Jr. with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, he's going to receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors. That's Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We will send those down to Al, and I'm sure he'll put them to good use, considering the fact that all he seems to do is win these days.
Yeah, he's on a roll, and a great guy, if you couldn't tell. he's really a nice man.
Yeah, so many different storylines that you can talk about with Al Stahl. Not only his personal interests and things he enjoys doing away from the racetrack, which is interesting because so many trainers that we've had on this program, you ask them to talk about other interests and things they enjoy doing away from racing, and they can't really tell you much because their whole life is racing. Al's whole life is racing, but he's been able to balance it with his family, his personal life, and his interest in some other things.
I think that's kind of a New Orleans thing. You know, it's such an interesting town. It has such a tremendous history, and racing is important there. And so you have to be able to be a person that likes to go out and enjoy life. That's part of the New Orleans culture. So it's not like trainers from New York or California or whatever, that they may go out once in a while, but in New Orleans, that is life, is being with friends and participating in, you know, crawfish boils and parties and parades. That's part of life there. And if you take that away, you're not, you know, you're kind of a weirdo.
Yeah. Right.
So it's one of those things where, you know, you have to do that, and it's a joy. I mean, anybody that's spent any time in New Orleans knows what a great town it is, and how much fun it is to be there, and the history that's there. So that you have that part of Al, and then you have the serious horse racing part, and then you have the not so serious horse racing part, where it is fun. He
Yep.
still has that love of life and the joy that comes from training horses, not necessarily the stress. He's very zen in how he thinks about racing and the ups and downs, how he takes the curves. Everybody's, you know, lives through rough times in racing, but it's how you take those bumps that make a big difference. So, you know, a real interesting guy, Al Stahl. Very cool.
Yeah, and if you want to go back and listen to more of his early life and his personal stories when he was growing up around New Orleans, you can do that with the first Trainer Talk show that he appeared on back in 2012. It's posted on our website. You go to the search tab and just search Al Stahl Jr. That show also featured Mark Cassie in the first half of the program. As I mentioned earlier, we were doing two trainers at a time and interviewing two trainers at a time on those shows. So it was about 30 minutes with Mark Cassie, 30 minutes with Al Stahl Jr., and some great things coming out. I mentioned that Al almost took a completely separate career path. He was considering getting into the oil business, or he was in the oil business for a short time, and then decided after everything kind of took some twists and turns that maybe it was better he just went and focused back on horse racing again.
Yeah, well, yeah, if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. That's the old saying. You mentioned he was studying geology.
Yeah.
He's going to break rocks.
He's a smart guy.
He is a very smart guy.
Yeah, extremely intelligent, really good trainer. And one horse I wanted to ask him about, as we were kind of getting short on time here tonight, but I wanted to ask him about JB's Thunder. Do you remember JB's Thunder?
Yeah. Wasn't he on the Derby trail for a while?
Yeah. He won the Breeders' Futurity as a two-year-old at Keeneland back in 2010. And yeah, he was on the Derby trail for a while.
Yeah. One of these days, I'll get a Derby horse, and then we'll have some fun.
You know, isn't that funny? As I was doing some research for this program, I went back and looked at the Kentucky Derby media guide, and I said, geez, I'm going to just double check myself and make sure that Al hasn't had a Derby starter. Because in my mind, I was thinking he has to have a couple. Al has never had a starter in the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah, not surprising, though.
Really?
I think he's the kind of guy that he only wants to go there if he thinks he has a legitimate chance.
Yep.
He's not one of those guys that wants to go. And even at the Derby, you can't say get a free lunch because there's no free anything.
Yeah,
but
that's true.
I mean, you know, he's a guy that, you know, takes pride in his horses and his stable and places them where they belong, and you know, it's not surprising if he doesn't have one of the ones. If he doesn't think he can be right there, you won't see his horse in there.
Yeah, by the way, JB's Thunder won that Breeders' Futurity at Keeneland in 2010, came back in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile about a month later and finished ninth, and was really never the same after that. He never won another race after winning the Breeders' Futurity, and that's disappointing because he started his career with a maiden win at Saratoga first time out, then that win in the Breeders' Futurity, and then 0-5 after that, never hit the board again.
Yeah, well, it happens. You know.
I like this story about the Morning Glories, too.
Yeah.
About how frustrating that is for a trainer. You must know that.
Oh, it's terrible. I had a horse one time, Bobasaurus, and Gary Stevens worked him one morning at Santa Anita, and he got off the horse, and he said, Jude, we're going to win the Kentucky Derby with this horse. Well, now you hear that from Gary Stevens, Hall of Fame jockey, right? He's working horses for all the big trainers, and you go, wow, this is too cool.
Where do I sign?
Yeah, yeah. He broke his mane for $5,000 at Turf Paradise. So he was...
Did Gary ride him that day?
Gary rode him the first two times. The first time he ran, we all bet on him, thought he was going to win, and you know, he ran seventh or something, and Gary came back and said, I don't know. He said, let's try him again. So we tried him again. After that, Gary said, I'm done. You know, so what can you do?
All right, we're going to do this more and more often for you here on Trainer Talk. We'll visit with some of those big-name trainers who joined us in the early days of Trainer Talk, and we'll spend an extended visit with them and cover some more topics and talk about their big-time horses. So stay tuned for those. Quick programming note for those of you tuning into our Saturday morning Equine Forum show this weekend. Starting this weekend on Sirius XM, that show, typically on Sirius 93, will now be Sirius 219 XM 206, 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern every Saturday morning, Sirius 219 XM 206. For our special guest, Al Stahl Jr., for our producer, Lee Delapina, and for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Pennell. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk.